The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. On this edition of Century, Psychedelics in Recovery, the Association for Multidisciplinary Education and Research on Substance Use and Addiction, AMRSA for short, held its 49th annual national conference November 13th through 15th right here in my hometown of Portland, Oregon. So of course I attended, did some networking, got some great interviews. And on this edition of Century of Lies, we'll hear some of that audio. But first, Congress on November 12th approved a deal to reopen the government. Tucked away in that appropriations measure was a provision to essentially modify the definition of hemp. Opponents of that provision have characterized it as an industry killer. We'll be talking more about changes in federal hemp regulations and the expected impact of those changes on the hemp industry in future shows. For now, let's listen in on the Senate floor from November 10th. The first speaker will be Senator Rand Paul, Republican of Kentucky. He's followed by Senator Jeff Merkley, Democrat of Oregon, and then Senator Mitch McConnell, Republican of Kentucky.
Instead of a clean CR, this bill contains language that has been airdropped in that will destroy hemp farming in Kentucky and across the United States. Tucked away on page 163, Title 7, Division B of this spending package is a provision that will shut down the hemp industry across the United States. My amendment would strip the provision designed to regulate the hemp industry to death. The bill as it now stands overrides the regulatory frameworks of several states, cancels the collective decisions of hemp consumers, and destroys the livelihoods of hemp farmers. And it couldn't come at a worse time for America's farmers. Times are tough for our farmers. Farmers' costs have increased as the price of fertilizer and machinery have jumped, while prices for their crops like soybean, corn, and wheat have declined. For many farmers, hemp has proved to be a lifeline, a new cash crop. Farmers turn to growing hemp to mitigate the losses they've endured during this season of hardship. But that lifeline may soon be extinguished by this very legislation. The effective hemp ban included in this spending package is a result, we are told, of bad actors skirting the legal limits by overly enhancing the concentration of THC in their products. The hemp industry, myself and others, have come together and we have been willing to negotiate to get rid of the bad actors. And yet, instead, we are met with legislation that would be prohibition. Members of the industry, myself and others who are advocates of this, have been willing to get rid of synthetic cannabinoids. We have been willing to compromise at every turn, but we're met with the numbers in this bill which will eradicate the hemp industry. For the last several weeks, we've offered proposals with the goal of creating an environment in which the hemp industry could thrive and sell products. And we've been met with those who want to prohibit the industry from continuing. This bill's per-serving THC content limit would make illegal any hemp product that contains more than 0.4 milligrams. That would be nearly 100% of the existing market. The numbers put forward in this bill will eliminate 100% of the hemp products in our country. That amounts to an effective ban because the limit is so low that the products intended to manage pain or anxiety will lose their effect. The states have done what they're supposed to. The states have instituted laws. 23 states have instituted laws on hemp. None of them have limits anywhere close to what is being proposed in this bill. So what will happen is most of the things that your states have regulated, are regulating, and have made legal will be made illegal by this bill. This bill will effectively preempt and nullify all state laws concerning hemp. Currently, Maine limits THC to 3 milligrams per serving. That will be overruled. My home state limits THC to 5 milligrams in beverages. That will be overruled. Minnesota, Utah, Louisiana also have 5 milligrams per serving. Alabama and Georgia have 10 milligrams. Tennessee has 15 milligrams. The bill before us nullifies all these state laws and makes the hemp industry kaput. The language in this bill will outlaw all current hemp plants and seeds. It changes the definition of what a hemp plant is. It makes it so low that there may not even be an existing plant that can meet the parameters. But every plant in the country will have to be destroyed. Every hemp seed in the country will have to be destroyed. This is the most thoughtless, ignorant proposal to an industry that I've seen in a long, long time. The states have made progress, and more progress was coming. Most states have age limits. To add insult to injury, we are given this legislation in an appropriation bill. We have Senate rules against this. So I would recommend that we vote for this amendment, and my amendment would strip out the language, and I would like to transfer the remainder of my time to Senator Merkley.
Mr. President, thank you very much.
Before I recognize the senator from Oregon, I know it's late, but if everybody could take their conversations off the floor and give the respect to the speaker, please.
I recognize the
senator from Oregon.
Thank you, Mr. President. I really ask my colleagues, particularly on this side, to hear me out on this. The senators from Kentucky and Oregon cooperated to create the first research on hemp. We cooperated to give the first opportunity to move research seeds across state lines. We cooperated and pushed to create hemp as a legitimate agricultural product. CBD derived from hemp has been approved by the FDA for treating seizures. It is a legal medicine. We would wipe out an industry that we have spent more than a decade creating. Now, the advocates for this language that's in the bill will tell you this won't affect CBD. Every expert I've consulted has said that is exactly wrong, that this will, in fact, wipe out 95 to 99% of the industry. My colleague from Kentucky is exactly right. We asked our farmers to engage in this research. We asked them to build this industry. We should protect it for CBD. I support my other colleague from Kentucky who doesn't want intoxicated products produced from hemp. But the definition that is in this bill does far more than that, and it has to be fixed. So for now, it needs to be stripped out. Please support Senator Paul's position.
Mr. Rogers.
I recognize the senator from Kentucky.
The language I helped secure in the Agriculture Appropriations Bill addresses a serious concern regarding the manufacturing and selling of unregulated, intoxicating THC products nationwide. I led the effort to legalize industrial hemp through the 2014 pilot program and the 2018 Farm Bill. Unfortunately, companies have exploited a loophole in the 2018 legislation by taking legal amounts of THC from hemp and turning it into intoxicating substances, and then marketing it to children in candy-like packaging and selling it easily accessible places like gas stations and convenience stores all across our country. So children end up being the unknowing consuming of these poisonous products and being sent to the hospital at an alarming rate. My efforts to close the loophole and stop this from happening are included in this appropriations package. It will keep these dangerous products out of the hands of children while preserving the hemp industry for farmers. Industrial hemp and CBD will remain legal for industrial applications such as seed, stock, fiber, grain oil, or used in drug trials. This language merely classifies the original intent of the 2018 Farm Bill, rooting out the bad actors and protecting the growing hemp industry. While some may masquerade as advocates for hemp farmers, even sometimes threatening to hold up government funding over this issue, I'll continue to work on behalf of Kentucky's farmers while protecting our children, not only in my state, but in yours as well. I would urge my colleagues to do the same. Therefore, I move to table Senate Amendment 3941 and ask for the age.
The voice you just heard was Senator Mitch McConnell. He was preceded by Senators Rand Paul and Jeff Merkley. They were speaking on the Senate floor November 10th regarding an amendment proposed by Senator Paul, which would have stripped out language from the Appropriations Continuing Resolution that essentially redefines hemp, a change which could have a dramatic impact on the U.S. hemp industry. McConnell's motion to table the amendment, that is, to end discussion on the amendment and set it aside, moving on with debate on the larger bill, was approved on a vote of 76-24. Thus, the hemp provision remained in the legislation, which was finally approved by Congress November 12th and signed into law by the President. We'll be talking more about these changes and the expected impacts on the hemp industry and possibly on adult use and medical marijuana very soon on an upcoming edition of Century of Lies. So keep tuning in. You're listening to Century of Lies, and I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. I had the great good fortune of attending the 49th Annual National Conference of the Association for Multidisciplinary Education and Research on Substance Use and Addiction, AMRSA for short. It was a brilliant conference. So many amazing people in attendance doing a lot of really great work. One of the speakers at this year's conference was Kevin Franciotti, an addictions counselor, recovery advocate, writer, and one of the founders of a group called Psychedelics in Recovery. We sat down for a chat. Here's that conversation.
My name is Kevin Franciotti. I'm a licensed addiction counselor just outside of Denver.
Tell me about Psychedelics in Recovery. That's your organization.
Yeah, it's an organization I helped co-found about 10 years ago, starting informally in New York City with some folks that I knew personally from overlapping circles within both peer support recovery, namely the 12-step world and the psychedelic world. Unbeknownst to me, even at that stage, there had been murmurings elsewhere that I would come to learn about later of similarly small, close-knit pockets of people orbiting recovery spaces and engaging with intentional psychedelic use. And we, in parallel, eventually would find each other, but all discovered on our own that there was a synergy here and we could potentially embark on a safe adoption of both of those worlds. And so back in 2015, we gave ourselves a name. We wanted to be very mindful and kind of overly cautious about not stirring any controversy because we just wanted to attract the people who might resonate more than we were out there looking to make a point. We were generally from the beginning concerned about getting a bad message into people's hands that were already struggling enough. We wanted to focus on safety. We wanted to build a network of experienced people who could potentially hold people who would come still struggling in the midst of some kind of active cycle or loved ones reaching out. So anyway, we agonized over a lot of very like important questions from a very early age or in our organization's life cycle. So much so that we hardly ever grew over the next couple of years. Just organizing any kind of movement proves very challenging. People have demanding schedules, blah, 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 blah. So that led us to going online in 2017. We had a gathering at a conference, which drew out people from all across the country. So we've shifted into an online fellowship 3 years prior to the pandemic. So right when the pandemic hit and lockdowns are going on all over the country, people in recovery swarmed to the internet to find online resources. And our SEO was unwittingly very good for putting in the words psychedelic and recovery into Google. It would be podcasts that I've appeared on. It would be news articles or popular press coverage of our organization. So our fellowship massively exploded in the spring into the summer of 2020. And ever since then, it set us on a path for formally organizing as a proper entity, which became last year an officially recognized 501c3 tax exempt nonprofit.
And congratulations. That's a miserable process, but
we had help, thankfully. Yeah. We're now worldwide. I mean, since we're on the internet, we technically had to choose a state to incorporate in. So we just did that in Colorado, where I moved to in 2020. So we're technically based there, but we have a footprint in the United Kingdom, in Australia, elsewhere, for a little while in South Africa, but predominantly in North America, Canada, and the U.S. in particular.
A lot of the discussion around psychedelics and recovery has involved psilocybin, LSD sometimes, or MDMA, but you're also, you have experience with Ibogaine.
Correct. My recovery, my personal story, I mentioned those sort of parallel movements going on. My personal story was that I was arrested, and like many young people, or nowadays doesn't really matter of age, people's first exposure to a recovery-oriented intervention comes when they meet with law enforcement, if they're engaged in activity associated with their addiction that leads them to violate the law. So my rehab stay in 2010 came after an arrest, and I was not really ready to embrace the level of, frankly, brutal honesty and the capacity to acknowledge that I was responsible for some of the things that were causing problems in my life, even if I had a recognizable sort of disorder. So I relapsed pretty quickly after not resonating much with what they were trying to teach me with in those programs. And 10 months later, I had long known about Ibogaine because I was involved in advocacy and activism as an undergrad, particularly around drug policy with Students of Sensible Drug Policy. That's how I believe I first crossed paths with you many years ago. And so I just responded to a loving intervention from my mom, an intervention in the sort of truest sense. Let me lovingly intervene on whatever my son is going through and see if I can reach him. So she just asked me, what's wrong? It doesn't seem like you've left your room in days. Is there something we can do to help? And that sincerity caused me to let my guard down and just acknowledge that I was using, I needed help, and I had a crazy question to ask, which would she support an Ibogaine treatment, namely to fund it for me, because I didn't think going back to rehab would be worth the time or money. So she deliberated over it for a day with my dad and then decided to support it. And in July of 2011, I flew across the country, still opiate dependent, and shot my last bag right before getting to the airport. I tried to hold out as long as I could, but apparently that wasn't long enough to not be in withdrawal for a good portion of my travel. So by the time I arrived at the clinic in Mexico, yeah, I was ready to go. I did this because I heard that Ibogaine helps to attenuate the symptoms of opiate withdrawal. That's what appealed to me, like many people who want to get clean, so to speak, or stabilize, or just simply titrate down. It's a very uncomfortable process. So Ibogaine was given to me the day after I first arrived at the treatment center, in the form of a hydrochloride capsules, semi-synthetically extracted from an actual Iboga alternative source called Voaconga. But nevertheless, Ibogaine is the active molecule. So my journey was incredibly profound. It was not a challenging ordeal psychologically. Instead, it was this beautiful opportunity to spend 10 hours in a kind of blissful psychedelic state where I rediscovered all of the things that I always loved about being alive and being me, and had just recollections of things I used to think about as a child, and just bringing me back into this honest spirit of being grateful. And that type of experience is not the typical experience one would expect in a traditional detox setting. It's brutal. It's grueling. You are fighting for every minute to not just bolt out the door and go score. And, you know, I had some of that too, coming down from the experience, but I was also in a strange place. So I committed to seeing the anguish of the physical withdrawal through. And it also propelled me to be more open-minded to consider the path that was offered me the year previously that I was closed-minded to up until that point.
How has that experience informed your work in psychedelics in recovery? Which I love the name, Person in Recovery, Psychedelics in Recovery. It's cool.
It's funny, the name kind of just, I came up with it as a placeholder. We were like, should we be an anonymous thing, or would that be confusing? Would people think we are a recovery organization from psychedelics? So I was like, you know what, let's just stop. We'll think of something better later. So we'll just do psychedelics in recovery for now. And that's stuck since then. So I say that we're thoughtful and intentional, not at all times, but we also just sort of see what happens and work from there. My Ibogaine experience definitely, you know, it would inform the kind of conceptualization of wedding a psychedelic experience to overcoming addiction. But really, it was sinking my teeth more deeply into the 12-step program. I didn't grasp everything. I'm not a fan of Narcotics Anonymous's position on medications for opiate use disorder. I'm not a fan of some of the like semantic acrobatics they suggest to people, say a heroin addict who goes to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, because that's just what's available to them, and they have to play the game of identifying as an alcoholic. All these strange kind of idiosyncrasies, just I was like, you know what? I don't care. I don't need to dwell in all of that. Let me just learn about the program. Let me do all the things that are suggested to me. I found a home group. I did service positions like brew the coffee or greet people at the door or be the group's secretary for their business meetings. And I started to find a voice in sharing my experience, strength, and hope. The main thing that was critically missing was comfort using that space, that forum, that fellowship to openly talk about my psychedelic experience. It wasn't ostracized. I wasn't alienated. I wasn't shamed for it. It brought a confusing distraction that I didn't really care to spend time in. So I sort of self-censored myself. I didn't want to speak at an NA meeting and talk about my Ibogaine treatment. I wanted instead to refer to a powerful detox experience that I had that propelled me to embracing the program. So, you know, it wasn't a great solution, but it's because of that I held out long enough to truly absorb the tenets of the program separate from the utilization of psychedelics. But I continued to see the synergy. I continued to see the utility of applying the 12 steps that Alcoholics Anonymous describes in the Big Book as a design for living, which to me was a well-incubated, fleshed-out program of integration. And that is a term that I had heard a lot about psychedelics. It's not necessarily just the experience that you need to have. It's how you integrate lifestyle changes based on the insights that may have been generated from an experience. And most importantly, having a community of peers, of like-minded people, that we're not a doctor, we're not a therapist, we're not a researcher, certainly not a politician, but just average people that you come across in this sort of spiritual way of living. So that part of it wound up being the critical piece of assembling psychedelics in recovery. How could we have that around the openness that many of our members feel called to be a part of?
Well, and that's, I guess, the question. It's grown, psychedelics in recovery has grown beyond the core group of people who created the thing. How many, about how many folks do you estimate you're working with these days?
Yeah, I would say, I mean, we've been around for 10 years. We really started to exponentially grow about 5 years ago, and we have the same sorts of difficulties precisely estimating the size of our fellowship, but that's okay. I can say that my impression over the past 5 years especially is, you know, thousands of people have come to a PIR meeting. Fewer than that, you know, stay, but at this point, you know, we've grown to over a couple of dozen meetings online every week, and very, very few times over the past 5 years has a new meeting ever had to close. So that is an indication that we've arrived at a certain level of consistent infrastructure, and we've got about 100 people that are like truly inspired and dedicated to show up to a literature committee about brainstorming ideas to put our message in writing that we could publish it in our website. So all of these sort of things that you see in 12-step organizations really came together importantly. So at this stage, about on a monthly basis, I would probably estimate anywhere near 500 to 700 people are actively checking out PIR's meetings.
And even if they don't come back the next month, they might the month after that.
Or exactly.
The one, it's about creating that. It's about creating that. It's making the contact and creating that kind of rapport, building that trust. What have I not asked that I should?
I think just to say, why am I here, right? Why am I?
Oh yeah, why are you here?
Immersive.
You were actually in this. There was a. You presented a little while ago.
Our session was the Dr. Richard Seitz endowed plenary. It's ever since he passed away, I believe it was in 2022. He was known for a mantra of "Where's the evidence? Show me the data. Let's follow the data." So in his unfortunate passing, his devotion to this organization funded an annual plenary at this meeting. And so this year's topic was psychedelics for substance use disorders. And because of my advocacy and outreach efforts and interest in participating in the discussions in the psychedelic field, I've met many of the leading researchers and have in some cases collaborated with some. So my name and my voice that both represents PIR, but also my activities overall as an addiction counselor and as a devoted member of the field of people looking to help address the impact of addiction in the United States has me get considered for things like this. So my name was sent around a list and I was invited by the committee to come out here and speak. So I do things like this to engage with the community of really dedicated researchers from across the medical field, the public health field, everybody who shows up at IMRSA. This feels like exactly the kind of place to carry a message of what is going on out there in the world that may not be readily known. So this community of people that we've been helping to organize over the past 10 years sort of allows us to promote in the sense of the getting the concept out there. We're not trying to grow our membership so that we could receive more donations, so that we could receive, you know, more better reputation. It's to just sort of send signals out to these groups to have something to offer people who might show up in their office and say, "Where can I go? Where can I go after I do a ketamine treatment for depression, knowing that I can't really talk about it comfortably in AA besides a couple of people?" Well, you don't need to abandon AA. You can come to PIR as well. So it's all these kinds of small things that keep me very motivated to show up in spaces like this. So I was really honored to have the opportunity to do that here.
That was my conversation with Kevin Franciotti, an addictions counselor, recovery advocate, writer, and one of the founders of a group called Psychedelics in Recovery. We spoke at the 49th Annual National Conference of the Association for Multidisciplinary Education and Research on Substance Use and Addiction, which took place recently in my hometown of Portland, Oregon. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Find this edition of Century, along with an archive of past shows, at the Drug Truth Network website, drugtruth.net. You'll find a link there to subscribe to the Century of Lies podcast. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy and the failed war on drugs. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long.
For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.